So the first thing I want to mention is the meditation reviews starting this evening. The main thing you're doing in meditation reviews is you're going along and telling the person that is reviewing you what you're doing in meditation. That's the question. What are you doing and how is it going? That's the main thing. It can open out from there, but that's pretty much what you're doing. What are you doing in the meditations? And how is it going? Yeah. If you could go a little bit, a minute or two early to where you're going, and Paraga's group, where's Paraga gone? Is meeting in the Red On room, sounds very posh, not the other, the garden room, that's right. Just in case. Sorry? The Red On room, yeah. Sounds very posh. And if you could, when you arrive, if you can just give a little tap on the door, and that just tells the person doing the reviews that the next person's there. Otherwise, you get quite absorbed doing the reviews and you don't quite know what the time is. It's ideal. So they'll start from tonight, so you'll be having reviews every other evening. I was going to extend the silence, but I'm quite liking it as it is. So we'll leave the silence as it is at the moment up till lunch. Yeah. We might extend it later on. Okay, so what we've been doing so far is exploring this arc of sadhana, this shape of sadhana. I'm using sadhana, I think, as a portmanteau word, I think that's a word, to talk about the whole shape, not just the so-called visualization practice. So first of all, you settle into your posture and so on, stepping directly into the meditation, not hanging about, just trying to decide whether to meditate or not. Then cultivating samadhi. The main areas I've talked about is not taking the remembering that you'll be working on the hindrances. Every time you sit to meditation, you'll be working on the hindrances. Meditation highlights the hindrances, so you'll notice them more, and that's a good thing. So you don't need to let that undermine you, that you're noticing it more. Trying not to take the hindrances personally. Easier said than done, but then most things are easier said than done. And trying not to get caught up in their perspective. That's all that I've been saying about the hindrances. Remembering that the hindrances come and go in waves. And then, I'll leave you to, there's lots of things we've taught about how to work with the hindrances, but those are the principles. And then I talked about the fact that the main thing that stops us getting into samadhi, into this new state of consciousness that unifies calm with energy, this new state that we're trying to arrive in, which is so important because if you remember, it's malleable, so that your consciousness is softened and made malleable, which means that insights can press into you, as it were, rather than just bounce off you. So your mind is malleable. Your mind is refined so that you can come to do the sadhana. And there was something else about your mind. steady, that's right, thank you. Glad someone's listening. And you're cultivating that steadiness, and that steadiness is all important. Yeah. So you're looking to move into samadhi for those reasons, steadiness, malleability, refinement, so that you can do the sadhana and it really affect you. Otherwise, it's just thinking very often. The main barrier to that is tightening. Yeah. Any kind of constriction, tightening, blockages in your whole physical and energetic experience. One thing I didn't mention is sometimes it's really good to look for sort of tightening and blockages right at the core of your body. Some people are very sort of relaxed on top, very, very tight underneath. So really looking for subtler holdings. Like Anoop was mentioning to me that he'd been thinking about cricket. And if you drop through the exciting narratives about cricket, what you notice is there's a lot of grasping on, a lot of holding on. Yeah. As soon as I start thinking about publishing poems, I start to tighten up in that very moment. Each to their own, but so you're trying to drop through the narrative of propuncture and notice the gripping, holding on, clasping, blocking that goes with that, that's echoed in and expressed through the body particularly. The body is often the very useful way of getting a sense of it. So you're constantly trying to drop through propuncture into grasping, holding on, tightening, yeah. And try to look for that more and more subtly. So as I said, feeling sleepy is a kind of grasp, a kind of blockage, dullness. One of the things that I notice, I don't know whether you do this, but I think, again, these things become very habitual, so you don't notice. But I've very much had this strong sort of tendency to try and do something in meditation, and instead of doing it, keep on looking to see whether it's working. So I sit down and think, okay, all this sounds nice, loosening, tightening, and then I try it for a bit. Does it work? I keep on, it's like opening one eye to see whether it's worked or not. Or it's like planting a plant and keep pulling it up to see whether it's growing or not. So things like that, habits like that, can run on without you noticing. I keep noticing that I've got a very strong kind of ambition, quiet ambition, that makes me want to achieve things in everything I do, which means I'm constantly checking whether it's worked or not. But it's not very conscious. It sort of flows along quietly on its own. So you're trying to notice those much more subtle samskaras. Are you trying to achieve something, which will mean you'll keep on checking if you have or not, and then getting into pride if you have achieved something, and getting into despair if you haven't. Yeah. So trying to see those kind of quietly running patternings, and there'll be a concomitant, it'll also be expressed in a kind of clinging. Yeah. So you're looking for tightening, looking for any kind of blocking, and looking at it in more and more subtle ways. So as we go through, what I'd like you to do in each meditation now, you start building like that, working to settle for a little bit, then working to notice what hindrance you're in, then start to really work on this level of clinging and grasping and tightening, and then see if you can look for pleasure as the last thing I was talking about. Subtly, gently keep an eye out for pleasure. One of the ways that I've been using a lot is just sitting in the whole body, attending to all the body sensations, and just see if you can start to tune into the more pleasant frequencies. And then you're trying to have those pleasant frequencies saturate your whole body and mind. Yeah? And as I said, you can do that by doing the metta. You can do that by doing the mindfulness of breathing and feeling the pleasure of the breath. You can just quite literally just bring to mind something that brings pleasure to you, something ethical that brings pleasure to you, a memory, an image. You can imagine your body filling with pleasure. You can sort of picture yourself what you'd feel like if there was lots of pleasure just now. Just be careful not to try and grab at pleasure, because that just pushes it away. And of course, part of all that sort of subtly looking for that kind of range of even very subtle pleasant sensations is not pushing away unpleasant sensations. So often we're trying to do something in a binocular kind of way, not pushing away unpleasant sensations, gently looking for more pleasant sensations and trying to rest in them more, even if they're very, very mild and seemingly inconsequential. I don't know, like the warmth of your blanket. And again, remember, it's the steadiness of pleasure that's important, not the strength of it. Yeah. I think it's very, very important to look for pleasure. Once you experience pleasure in meditation, what it does is it makes you want to meditate. I've come to think that all this teaching in meditation, it's all very well. The main thing I think you end up with is sitting down and actually want to meditate. In a certain sense, that's all you need to get into this room and actually emotionally want to meditate. And then on that, you start to work more creatively, you're more playful, more experimental, which means the meditation will go better. You're less aversive, which means the meditation will go better. Next day, probably you'll want to meditate again. A lot of it comes down to whether you want to do it or not, and then fostering that wanting to. And wanting to do it means not giving yourself a hard time when you feel like you can't, or you're not getting very far, because that just makes it feel more and more of a chore, and then the next time you won't want to do it. See what I mean? That's one of the reasons why sort of kindness is so important, bringing kindness to your experience. Something very mysterious, I think, about wanting to do anything. It's not simply a mental decision, it's something that arises within yourself.
I'm just going to go back to what you were talking about, checking whether what you're doing is working or not. And then, because yesterday you said sometimes when I was talking to you about getting into that more intuitive stage, and you said you deliberately stopped to see whether you're on the right track or not. Is the difference between the two that one's habitual and one's conscious? Because I know I do them both, and I'm just sort of...
See, I think this question of being conscious is the thing. For me, the analogy is writing poems, I'm afraid. Don't worry, just have a quick discussion of poetry. But if you want to write a poem about Iran or the bombing in Syria, probably it's going to be rubbish, because it's very highly conscious, you know what you want to say, you're going to sort of take some moral position on it and so on. Normally never works. If you're, I saw those swans lying in the fields. There's seen something unusual and beautiful about that. Something that you don't know why, but wants to be followed up. Now, when you write a poem, you are conscious, and you are steering it, but there's this equipoise between conscious intention and things arising intuitively, even... luckily, if you see what I mean. So I think in meditation you're looking for that. Conscious intention, but not so that it stops your experience coming up to you, if you see what I mean. It's a delicate balance, I think, between a kind of consciousness and a kind of unconsciousness. Intuition and reason, really. And probably you need to get both wings, balanced, if you see what I mean. And it sounds like sometimes you go more towards intuition, but then you can't tell if it's just habituation or not. And I think it is difficult to tell. And you need to discover it, if you know what I mean. Don't always know how to sort of even say how one does that. It's an aesthetic sense partly, isn't it? I think any time you go deeper in meditation, one of the signs of going deeper is if your experience feels more aesthetic. The whole of your inner sense feels more aesthetic, even if it's painful, feels more aesthetic. So you could look for that, an aesthetic sense in meditation. If it's aesthetic and beautiful, even if it's painful, probably going in the right direction. Habituation usually is a bit dull. Anyway, that's where we've gone so far. So what I want to bring in now is moving on to the next level of sadhana, which is the blue sky of shunyata. And really, for the next quite a few days, I don't know how many, we'll be exploring this element of sadhana, the blue sky. So you prepared for the entering the blue sky by cultivating samadhi. Having this pleasurable, stable, unified, harmonious, flexible mind. And then you need to enter into the blue sky. We need to enter the blue sky. So I'll say a little bit about this, and then we'll do it. Mostly the tradition is that you develop samadhi, and on the basis of developing samadhi, you start to develop pranayama. I'd like to use that term rather than insight or any of the other terms, because very difficult to find a word that works. And I prefer pranayama, I think, working with samadhi and pranayama. Even the term wisdom, Bhante says, it's not a very good translation of wisdom, of pranayama. It's a bit too, it easily feels heady. And usually when we move into pranayama reflections, one of the issues is not just moving into heady thinking about things. And then if you do it like that, then you just, it doesn't work, and then you don't do it. So what I want to do for the next few days is introduce reflecting, if that's the right word, on the lakshanas. Yeah? And I want to take them each individually as your way into the blue sky. The blue sky represents, doesn't it, impermanence, in substantiality. It represents shunyata, it's the magic nature of experience. I can't even say what it is at the moment. Certainly not emptiness, but it's, Bhante translates as the open dimension of being, doesn't it? Mystery. Gunther. Gunther, yeah. Bhante likes it to translate something as mystery, doesn't it? So you're entering into a mystery. In that mystery, self as we know it needs to die. So this whole the blue sky part of a sadhana, either at the start of the visualization or at the end of it, represents spiritual death. And it's moving into spiritual death I want to bring in now. Generally, the tradition has been that samadhi and then pranayama, but also in some of the Pali, you get the Buddha teaching people who are having insight experiences to cultivate more samatha, to cultivate more samadhi, and vice versa. So the other way of looking at it is that you need the both. You need a samatha, samadhi element, and you need a pranayama element. And that they help each other. I've been finding that bringing in more pranayama reflection is actually deepening my samadhi, if you know what I mean. Partly because it uses my mind a bit more.
What's the difference between samadhi and samatha?
Samatha just means stop. It's often, samatha vipassana is often just simply translated as stop, realise, isn't it? So samadhi is what Bhante would call meditation proper, which is the dhyanas. So they support each other, yeah. So the first thing we're going to be trying to bring in is reflecting on impermanence. I haven't been doing this one in my own meditations that much, so I might not have quite as much to say about this one. So the first thing to say is reflecting on impermanence is not thinking about it, just thinking about stuff. What I notice with any kind of reflection on impermanence, it's very difficult to get under the skin of it. All things are impermanent. Somehow it's very difficult to have that mean anything very much. We can all say it, we can all give great big long talks about it. Some of us can write lyrical poems about it. Very difficult to have it, to get under the skin of it very much, for it to be more than just a thought, a Buddhist-y thought, even a platitude if you're not careful. And platitudes inoculate you against the insight they're trying to point towards. So what I'm suggesting is in this meditation, first of all, bring up the view that all things are impermanent. Yeah? You consciously engage with that view. And I don't know whether I can even describe it, but once you engage with a view of something, your experience starts to change. If you can take up that view, if you look at your experience through that lens, the experience itself changes a little bit. So what we're trying to do in going into the blue sky in this way is consciously taking up the lens of impermanence, looking at our experience as being impermanent, and then trying to feel, experience that impermanence. Yeah. So these are kind of insightful ways of looking, pranyar ways of looking. You just take up the view that your experience is impermanent. And then what I suggest you do is you can do the stages I've already been teaching, and then take up this view that all things are impermanent. And then first of all, really explore your body sensations. I mean, this is how I thought we could start it, at least. Really get close up to your body sensations, as close as you can, by which I mean dropping analysis of those sensations. So often our experience is kind of a monologue about our experience, whether it's about the breath or about the body. Try and get close as possible to direct physical experience. And just notice that they're changing. Yeah? Constantly changing. You don't need to... Sometimes when people try and do this, they try to kind of make the process of changing more... You know, very, very rapid. Do you see what I mean? When you go from that change, you try and spot it moment to moment. Actually, that just makes you tense again. So you don't need to try and do that. You're not trying to sort of capture each milli moment as if it really, moments really exist, and you can break down experience to, you know, changing moments. It's not like that. That just tightens you right up. You just take in this attitude that all of my body sensations here and now are impermanent. Let me feel them arising and ceasing. Take that attitude to body sensation. It's particularly useful when you're something like tired or ill or in physical discomfort. Really go up to those sensations and see that those sensations are changing. They're not just a stable block. So when you, like I've been feeling quite tired, I haven't been sleeping very well, have that horrible kind of sinky feeling. It's not just a sort of block. It does change, and tune in to the changingness of it. Yeah? Or if you've got physical discomfort, it's not just a thing that you're experiencing. It's a fluctuating, changing pattern of sensation. Tune into that. Yeah. The thing is that you're not thinking about it. You're stepping out of thought into direct sensations, noticing it's changingness, yeah? After you did that, or you've done that for a while, you can include sounds. Something about listening itself, which is often quietens the mind down. But just listen to sounds and just notice the fact, by which I mean just experience that they come and go. Really get up close to sounds and tune into the fact that they're impermanent. Yeah? Then you might include Vedana. Pleasant, unpleasant and neutral. It's very important that the idea of this, of reflection, is you're trying to be as global as possible. So you're trying to take that view of impermanence to every aspect of your experience. Your body, sounds, Vedana. And remember to include pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings and neutral feelings. So all of that is impermanent. We know that, but fat load of good, our knowledge does sometimes. We're trying to see that, feel that, experience it. Yeah? So you might take it into Vedana. If your mind settles down quite a lot on the basis of samadhi, you can notice also that your thoughts are impermanent. They come and go. It's more difficult to do that if your mind hasn't settled down. You'll tend to sort of chase after thoughts, and that will create more agitation. With this practice generally, just watch for tightening again. You have to keep on watching your attitude to what you're doing. Otherwise, you can just sort of I, when I've tried to do it, I tend to sort of get on my case too much. That's like I'm trying to cut a sausage into tiny little slices of impermanence. I mean, and it just gets too tight, too much on your own case. Yeah. So if you're getting like that, just step back into whole experience of your whole body. Looking again for stability, quiet, all that sort of thing. You can keep turning off pranayama back into samadhi. I mean, Bhante really emphasizes that you need a ground of samadhi. You need at least 50% of samadhi to have 50% of pranayama. Yeah? So you can keep changing if you want to into samadhi. If it's not, if you're getting tight, just go back to samadhi. Explore body sensations, sounds, vedana, and so on. See if you can go from particular changing sensations, like say you've got a pain somewhere, exploring that, and then go between that and feeling the whole space of your awareness again, the whole of your body, sounds, everything, the whole experience. Try and notice that that's impermanent. Yeah. So go from a sort of focused exploration to a broad one, yeah, as the broadest possible. And you're just tuning into the fact that all you can ever experience is changing. If you're subtle enough, you can even notice that consciousness itself is impermanent. That when you're aware of something, it's a moment of knowing, and that moment of knowing is impermanent. But that's much more subtle. At first, I'd work with the most obvious elements. Yeah, like if you sat down and you're feeling very emotionally turbulent, work straight away with that. Whatever presents itself most clearly to you. It might be your body, it might be that you're thinking a lot, it might be that you're upset about something or wanting to play cricket, or whatever it is. Work with whatever's presenting itself most strongly to you. And try and see its impermanent nature. Any questions about that before we have a go?
So I'm sort of predicting the future a little bit, and I'm imagining sex being the primary sort of thing presenting itself to me in meditations.
Well, thank you for that confession. You'll be the only one. Again, just try and drop through the fantasy and narration and feel that it tenses you up and go back into that then, that you're tensing up, and then try to go back into body sensations and feel them moving. Keep on dropping beneath the story into the direct experience, and then try and see that direct experience, whatever it is impermanent. Okay, I'll just say a little bit more and then we'll start again, do it again. What did I want to say? I mean, just stepping back for a moment, remembering that self and world are constructed. Something to get metaphysical on us. Self and world, time, etc. They're constructions, they're not realities. They're fabrications. Subhuti likes the word confections. The reason why you have confectionery is because you put like a nut, hazelnut and a bit of chocolate and caramel all together, you create a chocolate. Yeah. So our self-sense, our sense of being in the world, our sense of the world, it's all constructed. And we're doing that construction all the time. We're trying to stick the world together, stick ourselves in the world together all the time. So this first reflection is trying to undermine the glue, as it were, by seeing that the thing is actually impermanent. Whether it's the emotional state you're in just now, whether it's feeling tired just now, whether it's feeling blissful just now. There isn't a thing there. The more you look on it, what you experience is inconstancy, changingness, as it were, a constant inconstancy. So what we do is, against the flow of reality, against the flow of inconstancy, we grip and cling and make things. Yeah? So what we're trying to do in this, bringing this kind of attitude to bear onto our experience, is see through things into their inconstancy. See that even a painful knee, a blissful experience, a sexual craving, whatever it is not a thing that you can name and grasp and cling to, but a constantly changing phenomena. And you're trying to get closer and closer to that consciously, constantly changing phenomena. And what you're looking for is a release. Yeah? You're looking for a release of that clinging. Really, any kind of pranayama reflection, however you do it, six element practice, reflecting on this, on the lakshanas, you're always looking for a release of clinging. Because the cause of our dukkha, which we'll be coming to, is craving, clinging. The cause of our experience of a self in a world, we still have this idea that we're like a computer in a box, and then when the computer breaks down, there's still the box, but we're not there anymore, which can't be the case. So however you approach pranayama reflection, you're always trying to notice clinging and release clinging, however you're doing to do it. So we need, as we're doing this practice, not to try and speed things up so we're watching every micro moment, but look out for a sense of release. What you thought was clinging, that you clung to as a really existing thing, you're trying to see that it's actually constantly changing, like a cloud or the wind. So you can't cling to it anymore. And then, to the degree to which you're seeing that, what, as it were, should be happening is a release. Even a brightening, an opening, a sense of freedom. If you're getting into sense of despondency or dullness, that's nothing to do with impermanence. That's to do with aversion creeping in, usually. Yeah? You're not trying to go against your experience, you're just trying to realise that it's not what you think it is. Yeah? So you need to look out for things like boredom, aversion, despondency. That feeling of despondency is also impermanent. That feeling of aversion is impermanent, and you can even try and tune into the changing, rippling sensations of aversion, boredom, resistance, and so on. Yeah. So you can turn any hindrance, so to speak, into a way of reflecting on impermanence. So if you find you just don't want to be here, really try and feel that don't want to be here, and try and see that it's not a fixed thing that you're basically creating. Do you see what I mean? That, let's say, for instance, you sit down to meditate and you really don't want to be here. You wish, after all, you'd gone to Marbella on your sunny holiday. If you really don't want to be here, you sort of make it into a really existing thing, whereas actually that feeling of not wanting to be here fluctuates from moment to moment. And the more you can tune into that fluctuation, that inconstancy, the less you can grasp onto it, the less you can grip onto it. It starts to melt through your fingers. So just to be really clear, you're looking for this sense of release. Yeah? So if there's pain in the body, really getting really close up to that pain, starting to notice it's not a fixed thing that you're condemned to experience, but a minutely changing phenomena. Yeah. And then as you start to see that, you get little tiny experiences of release. So they might not, this release, this relief even, might not be very strong, might not be very marked, but it's got a slight taste of freedom to it. What you'd clung to as being really existent, either a positive thing or a negative thing or a neutral thing, turns out just to be a constantly changing flow. So keep an eye out for any sense of relief. And when you, if you get that, you can either sort of use that as a steering into samadhi, where you just then enjoy that sense of relief, let it spread through the body, experience the pleasure of that, and then go through into samadhi. Or you can just notice that and carry on the pranayama reflection, if you see what I mean. Sometimes you'll want to do one, sometimes you'll want to do another. Generally speaking, you need about a balance of the two. Without enough samadhi, you'll just sort of bounce off the reflection because you're just too heady, too preoccupied. Yeah. But what I've been finding in my own practice is that bringing in more pranayama, reflections like this, actually deepens my meditation. And then that means I can get into pranayama more. Any questions about that before? Yeah.
I think there's a danger of cheating myself when I, on the one hand, I can get a sense of the coming and going of phenomena, and I can get a sense of,
yes, that's right.
I agree, things are coming and going, this feeling wasn't there before, but now it's there, now it's gone. But cheating myself in terms of there's still Mark the observer who doesn't change.
I know
that I'm not there, but getting an experience of that there is even a changing observer, it's really difficult. And I can think, I'm getting closer to the impermanence thing, but it's not right because I'm still there and objects are changing, but I'm still here.
Even experiences are changing, but you're watching stably. That's right.
So how do I?
I mean, that's why it's important to reflect on all three lakshanas, so that you don't any one on its own you can get into problems with. I could go into that more, but. Try and notice that sense of actually the me watching it is stable, and try and see whether that, you can get into that. That's noticing consciousness, really. But yes, I know exactly. If you're not careful, I think it's a shame in a Buddhism in a way, because it's like you're given the answer, and if you're not careful, you just reiterate the answer, all things are impermanent, rather than discover that's true. You see what I mean? That thought, all things are impermanent, emotion, body, very often just stops any investigation. I sometimes say, is it impermanent? Ask open questions. So this pain I'm experiencing, is it impermanent? That's what I'm being told, but is it? Sometimes an open question is better than the all things are. It's just, in a way Buddhism gives you the answer, but we have to actually do the sum. And it's tempting to just reiterate the answer instead of doing the sum, if you see what I mean. So you're trying to feel that things are impermanent. And the part of you thinks that saying, when you notice you're saying, self saying, oh, that's impermanent, see if you can step out of that and realise that is also impermanent. It gets a bit discombobulating after a while, but notice that tendency to just come up with the answer, which usually just closes the reflection, interestingly, rather than opens it up. In what way is it impermanent? Is it impermanent? But looking for really getting close to sensation, Vedana, body sensation, sound, there's some lovely trucks earlier on, even if you can, consciousness, labelling, trying to get as close to it directly as possible and experience it as changing. And then try to notice any sense of relief you get from that. Rather than just reiterate the words.
If
If you get stuck in a hindrance where it becomes your view of the world,
yeah,
what would be your advice in that sense?
Well, sometimes you go back to samadhi, as it were. Okay. You can either take. What I always try and do is drop beneath the propuncture of the hindrance. The real hindrance is the mental state, not the words that you've got on top of it. The words are just an expression of the fact that you're anxious or craving. So you really need to get into that. When we talk about taking ownership of our hindrances, it's not the chatter, it's where the chatter is coming from. You need to feel into that, actually, I'm just wanting. And then either take a samadhi attitude to that or a pranya attitude to that. But usually people just notice the hindrance. They just think it's noticing the words they're saying in their mind, whether it's about sex or cricket or success or wanting to go to sleep or worrying about your health. Actually, you need to step into where it arises, which is an emotional, physical place. I'm anxious, I'm aversive. And really taking hold of that, that's what's happening. I'm feeling aversion just now. Where do I feel it? How do I feel it? Does it come and go? Is it true? I think quite often people mistake acknowledging the hindrance for acknowledging the story rather than the whole complex mental state that it's an expression of. So really get into how the hindrance feels in your body particularly.
Do you feel that it's always enough to just really feel the hindrance in an embodied way, to be working with it? Or what do you feel the role is also for sort of bringing in the crowbars and,
I haven't sort of mentioned that, but of course, sometimes you need to apply the antidotes, like we've taught for donkey's years. Sometimes that's what's needed. The hindrance is very sticky and you're not going to get anywhere unless you start applying the antidotes. So that's a sort of samatar way of approaching it. And sometimes that's exactly what you need to do. Part of the art of meditation is experimenting all the time. What do I need to do just now? And actually learning the terrain. I mean, my own metaphor I've been using for it is when you cycle on a mountain bike. When you're on a mountain bike, when you're doing it well, you're constantly changing gear according to the terrain you're in. So when you enter meditation, you're entering a terrain, sometimes more calm, sometimes very agitated, sometimes very preoccupied, sometimes very happy, sometimes excitable. And you need to be changing gear. I need to be changing gear that's appropriate to that terrain. So sometimes you sit down and realise it's no good me trying to bring any kind of reflection in the moment. I'm not yet ready to. Sometimes you need to drop your expectations because the terrain has changed very much. If you have a very good meditation, the next meditation often isn't very good or is much more difficult, and you have to change your expectations. So a lot of the art is constantly monitoring the actual terrain you're in now, bored, irritable, excitable, happy, calm, and changing gear in relationship to that. By changing gear, I mean changing your effort, changing your approach in relationship to the terrain you're actually in, not the terrain you'd like to be in, not the terrain you were in a minute ago, not the terrain you were in yesterday. Yeah? That's that constant monitoring of effort, attitude, approach, in relationship to the terrain of your mind, in any given meditation.